The $99 Cedar Point Gold Pass is back for a limited time. Get unlimited visits for the rest of this year and all of 2025, including unlimited hollow weekends and free parking. Don't wait, because the price goes up on September 3rd. Get your 2025 Gold Pass and start planning your visit at cedarpoint.com.
Welcome to another Britflix.com podcast. Today with me, I've got writer, actor Johnny Owen and actor Vicky McClure. Hello.
Hi. Hello. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Now, you're both involved with the film Svengali.
We are.
Johnny, you wrote and star in it, and Vicky, you star in it.
Yeah.
First off, Johnny, do you want to give us a sort of brief synopsis of the story and maybe your character, Dixie, and then Vicky, if you want to give us a bit of an insight into Shell.
Yeah, sure. Go on, John.
It's basically the story. It's set in the murky world of rock and roll, and it's about a postman from Wales who's always dreamt of discovering the next big thing. And he sees a band on the internet, on YouTube. He's convinced this is what music needs, you know, the answer to sort of X Factor and the current malaise. And off he sets to London to manage the band. And it's about sort of his adventures in trying to get this band signed and the people he meets along the way and sort of the trouble that he gets embroiled in. It's a classic story of somebody going to the big city to try and make it rich, I suppose, or to try and make it big. Alan McGee gave me a great line once, because I started them online. I'll talk about this later. Rock and roll is the only industry in the world where bad behaviour is actively encouraged. And I thought, what a great premise for any kind of drama and comedy in that. And I went away and sort of thought, you know, that's a perfect background for putting this character in that scenario. So that's kind of the basic synopsis of it, Vic.
Yes, I play Shell. And basically she's the main support for Dixie in his journey to go and manage this band who are completely reckless. She's the girlfriend, she's the support, and I'd say she's the brains behind it in some ways.
But yeah, she's his rock, certainly, isn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of all pulls
You've said from. That before, which is why I've nicked it, but it's probably not quite so accurate. She's not quite the brains, but yeah.
She's certainly over the rudder, hasn't she? She certainly makes sure he goes in the right direction.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but then that's what women do generally.
Is that right?
Life affecting art, affecting life, you do it.
Now, I'm in London now, not from London. Are you guys based in London now?
Well, I was for several years, obviously, and a lot of my experience first arriving is there in the film. We've now moved up to Nottingham because that's where Vicky's from, and we're together in real life, as they say.
Okay.
And she got quite homesick in London, so we ended up going back up to the East Midlands, and a very fine city it is too, I have to say.
That is life imitating art, quite literally, isn't it?
It is.
It is.
I mean, even sort of the journey of me trying to get the band signed kind of reflected what happened with me trying to get the film signed to a distributor and things later on. It was amazing.
Well, let's rewind the clock, because the first time I came across Svengali was ages before that I found out about the film.
Yeah.
I was one of your viewers for the web series.
Oh, bless you.
I'm a friend of one of your Valley colleagues, Tracy Mobley.
Oh, you've met Tracy. She came to the Welsh premiere on Tuesday night.
Yeah. I interviewed Tracy when I used to write for magazines like Days of Confused and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
She's a very
interesting woman, isn't she?
Indeed. And to be honest with you, this podcast prompted me to catch up with her. I've not seen her for ages, so I was out with her last week.
Oh, that's lovely. I mean, I'm probably going to see her. I'm hoping to see her this Tuesday for the London premiere. She's spending a lot more time in Wales now, but she's a native of Shoreditch as well.
Indeed, she is. Much
of the film is set, you know, a very well-known face around there.
So yeah, so let's. Do you want to talk about the genesis of Svengali then, as a web series, long before it was a film? Because I'm assuming there was a want to get it onto TV first.
There was. I mean, what happened was they kind of had the germ of the idea back in, I think it was 2008, and it shows how much things have changed, certainly in a technological sense, in that Twitter had only just started, and it used to take me hours to load it up onto YouTube, and you couldn't put more than sort of 6.5 minutes up. So all those sort of, I suppose, constraints, you know, informed how I did it. But I just sort of had the idea that the internet is full of stuff, you know, like kids on skateboards and people falling off ladders or whatever. Was there a possibility of putting something up with a story and a narrative and seeing what people thought? And it got a great response very quickly. It was picked up by the Evening Standard, and they said it was the best thing on the net, which was amazing. Mm. And then we got Alan McGee in it very quickly. And then more and more people sort of said they wanted to be in it. But obviously I was constrained to these sort of 5-minute episodes, and I was flirted with by every broadcaster production company there was. I think I went in to see everybody, and lots of different sort of people offered and said this and said that. But what happened was I had a great bit of advice from quite an unlikely source. Tim Lovejoy contacted me quite early doors, and he was running an online channel called Channel B at the time.
Okay.
And he sort of said to me, look, you know, I love it and all the rest of it, but alas, that little channel went bust and he had to go back onto mainstream television. This is about 2009. And he said to me, try and hold on to it for as long as you can, because the longer you hold on to it, the more successful it becomes, the more power you'll have when it finally, you know, gets made into whatever it's going to be made into, which is very, you know, interesting advice. And I did that. I stuck at that. And by the time a private investor got involved to make it into a movie, which seems a fantastical jump from a web series, they gave me total creative control, which was amazing. So I kind of had to sort of, I had to stand and fall really by the decisions I made, but it was, I liked that. I know it sounds, it's a lot of pressure, but I liked it because it kind of made me have to man up really and say, well, I'm going to have to do this, you know, after years of saying I could do that and do it better. But I got the position where the investors literally left me alone to make the film. We made the film, we took a hell of a chance, and then we showed it to distributors. And I think the second distributor that saw it was Universal, and they said, we want it. So that was it. We were kind of, you know, straight away in a position where you go into that never ending sort of chain of waiting to sort of see when it's going to go out. And it took about, let me see, from being signed to them seeing it, almost a year till they found the window that they said was the best window for us and ready to hit cinemas.
Okay. And I guess with it being the web series, you kind of had the best sort of training ground to make sure your stories stack up and stuff.
Yeah, I mean,
and your character of Dixie obviously is fully formed.
It was almost bloody 4 years in development really. And what happened was I had the amazing Henry Normal, who a lot of people say is one of the best script editors in the country. Mm-hmm. I had him all. He came on board as an exec producer, and he was all over me for the script. So I had to sort of really nail it down. You know, he'd sort of say to me, you know, the mechanics of script breaking, why does he do that, and why is that happening, why does that character do that, and the trajectory. He was just amazing, you know, it was an amazing education, and he kind of sort of really put me through the mill in that sense. And you know, it was an amazing sort of experience to have him coming back with notes, and you know, I couldn't have been in better hands really. But it was a long process of me thinking of how the series would expand into a series on television or a film. So I was able to sort of call on those ideas that I'd been developing over a few years really, and say, look, I think, you know, I would have, obviously you saw the web series, I wanted to bring the Prems into it. That was a very important part. I wanted to expand Michelle's part. I wanted to send him back home to Wales. So I was able to do all those things in the film.
I was going to say, where did that, because that's the Shell's role, Vicky's role as Shell is one that's not in the web series, but obviously one that's important to the film.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I needed a strong kind of female character and also a strong family base, because, I mean, a lot of my family is in his family, in the sense of, you know, I come from a very traditional working class background that was really rock solid and very nice to grow up in. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, British films do tend to be, as you would know better than anybody, sometimes very kitchen sink, or, you know, and traumatic, or, you know, sort of, you know, period piece dramas. I've always thought, where's the bit in the middle, you know, where most of us kind of live and survive?
Yeah,
you know?
No.
So I thought that, and I thought, I'm going to do that in this film. You know, those things that a lot of people have picked up on, where everybody tries to give him money when he goes back home. You know, he was a tenner. Doesn't matter how old you are, your father always tries to chuck that tenner at you or your mother. So I try to get all those things incorporated into it that, you know, sort of I'd experienced. And
I still get that when they come visiting me. Never mind.
I know, it's mad, isn't it? Doesn't matter how old you are. I think we could win the lottery. There's still got to be a moment where they go, you are, here's a fiver. You know, get yourself a few pints tonight or something. Or have a
but couch. I must admit, that's to be applauded in your film. There's obviously cynicism towards the music industry that runs all the way through it, but it doesn't mean that the people have to be awful and, you know, and having a hard time and everything. It's just, you know, people get on with their lives, don't they? That's the thing that...
Well, they do. I mean, that's why I wanted to set it in. Because obviously I was in a band myself in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
And it's such a hyper-reality film, music. And I was talking to this... A lot of the characters were based on characters I remember. You know, I remember this sort of somebody was the Mancunian is based on, was very well known in the music industry. Was always obviously on coke. You know, in the mid 90s and constantly at 100 miles an hour. Those kind of people that I remember very vividly. And I thought there's great scope there to put those in the film. And then when he goes back home to this very ordinary family, and again Henry gave me a great line. You know, he said you need people to be going, why did you even go to London? You know, you've got this amazing background and family and support system and mates, and why are you even there, you know, in this horrible murky world? But you know, the lights and the idea of being famous, like he said at the start, being known as a great Svengali, wanting to leave your mark on the world, is a great draw. You know, it's what goes on all over the world. People migrate to big cities to try and make their fortune and name. It's just, you know, it's just almost part of human nature. But the irony, of course, is we get to a certain age and we go, you know, what actually is important is being happy and having a nice family life and being in love and all the cliches. But the truth, as you get older, where you go, you know what, that's not important, actually, being Pete Doherty. What's being important is the guy that's really happy with his job and his, you know, having his mates.
No, totally.
Being in the pub on the weekend. So I wanted to get that across as well, you know.
Yeah, as someone that used to manage a band, I can vouch for the hyper reality for sure. I have to ask, did you play with NXS then?
I mean, I played with NXS, I played the Stereophonics. We were signed. We had all the trappings that you could want. You know, I tasted the sort of the most glorious fruit of all, which is the fruit of rock and roll success. You know, played big gigs and got flown to New York first class. Did all those things when I was in my 20s, and I was such. I mean, I know we all look back at ourselves, but we were such obnoxious little bastards. And the thing is, like you're saying, you're a manager of a band yourself. It's such a bloody thankless task, you know, being a manager. All you get is grief and them demanding to know why they aren't on the front cover of the NME and why isn't this happening, why isn't that happening. So you have to almost skillfully negotiate egos all the time. It's an amazing sort of thing to be a manager of a band, I think.
The best advice I ever got was somebody saying... Sit the band down and say, sometimes when we meet, there won't be any news.
Yeah, so true. So true. We used to get our manager, we used to have a guitarist, Lee, and our manager said years after, I used to dread his phone call because he used to always open the conversation by going, what's happening then? And Paul used to say, because he said, I used to make things up because I used to feel so under pressure. Oh, well, I've done this and I've done that and these are really interested. And he said, of course, what you do is you find yourself fabricating, lying, really. And of course, that's the worst thing because then a week later he goes, what happened to that gig and what happened to that thing you were going to do and what happened to that record company? So it's an awful thing to be in because I it's the same in an acting sense. I was talking to Vicky about it. All a manager can ever do is get the A&R man to see you. If you're good enough, they'll sign you. All your agent can ever do is get you the audition. It's up to you to get the part, you know. But a lot of the time, the artist, bless them, and I'm one, we tend to sort of, our egos can't cope with that sometimes. So we need something to blame. We just do. And so that blame goes somewhere else. And generally, it's the manager or the agent that gets it, you know. And so all that happens in the film, you know, where they're going to him. You know, they're even saying to him, why did you drag us up here? It's only, you know, it's three stops on the tube. That was a line I heard, you know, from us once when we were staying in the Columbia and we had to go meet up in Notting Hill. And I was going, why have you dragged us three stops on the tube, you know, on the Central Line? I can remember that in the mid-90s, looking back. What an obnoxious thing to say at the start of a meeting.
Vicky.
Yeah.
I was reading that your brush with kind of pop stardom was working with Madonna, as far as I mean, yeah, have you before talking about that kind of starstruck thing, have you been in bands and stuff? Is that in your past as well?
No, I've never been in bands. I used to dance, though. I danced from the age of 3. So I was always into performing and, you know, in some way. But, I'd like to have think, you know, I could have been the front runner for some band, but...
Well, she's kind of... She's hiding her legs under a bushel used to it because she's a touch of the Nottingham female Billy Elliot here because she was accepted into the Royal Ballet as a kid, weren't you?
Well... I nearly did. It was because I've got quite weak ankles. So when I went on point, I was never going to, you know, be strong enough. So actually, I didn't quite get accepted. But, you know, if I had better ankles, it would have gone my way.
She'd be in Swan Lake now rather than
Swan Lake.
Well, look, I mean, given the interview I've just done, it's not something I'd have asked because I never thought about it this way because I don't act. But the way that James Webb described Neil Maskell's approach to getting ready for the character that he was playing in the film, I just wonder from your point of view, Vicky, what was your approach to Shell, and does that differ from? Do you have a way of preparing for characters, or was it particularly?
To be fair, this was the first time in any role where I've played a character that's very close to my own character.
Okay.
So in terms of kind of, you know, doing any sort of method or, you know, working on a character in quite an intense way, I didn't really need to do it with this. We played around with, you know, what we expected her fashion to be like and what kind of music she'd be into and, you know, her background. And obviously I have got my own accent, so we've got a bit of a backstory there. And, you know, I think all that's extremely important in any job you do. You've got to know who you are and where you came from. And, you know, because Johnny was really flexible as well with sort of letting me improvise in certain ways. If you don't have that kind of information, it's a dangerous place to be, really, because you can't play around with it. But no, she was, you know, she was a lot of fun to play because I could kind of use a lot of my own humour and all that kind of thing, which was, you know, a real pleasure.
And in terms of the writing of it, then were you together before the film was made, or as the film was made, or
as the film was being made?
As the film was being made, really, it was okay. It was an organic process. I think.
I mean, I'm not being nosy. It's just more the fact that the process of writing the character and then having sort of conversations about developing
when
it.
When I first spoke to Johnny,
yeah,
you know, I'd read the script, and if I'd have just gone on the script all day long, it, you know, it would have been great, and you know, he'd already done the virals, and that character was already sort of in place. But he wanted to obviously give me the chance to sort of adapt it and do some different things with it. So I sort of rang him and sent him a picture of me with a scarf on my head and bright red lipstick and a leather jacket. And that's how I pictured her.
Okay.
And I think after that, Johnny kind of just, you know, adapted some of the script a bit to what we were playing around with. But it was already kind of there, and we just, you know, sometimes it's a bit like the Meadows effect. You kind of get on set and sometimes it just changes to what it was in the script. And that's why it's such an organically special film. And, you know, when you watch it, it just feels very real, as much as the comedy is sometimes, you know, it's quite out there. It's all possible.
Yeah, no,
just
no, no.
It makes it even funnier, really.
Yeah, no, that kind of, I mean, we're not always good at kind of heartwarming in British drama. We have to make everybody, we have to punish everybody for being alive.
Like, yeah.
As if life is one, you know, we're just waiting to go to heaven and life's punishment.
Mm. Yeah, no, the thing is with Sven, that's the whole point, is, you know, he's from a good family, he's got from a good home, there's no major tragedies, do you know what I mean? It's the tragedy is getting this bloody band together and the nightmare that occurs, and obviously, you know, Johnny's father, Dixie's father in it is dying, and it's a tragic story, but it's one that's happening, you know, all the time to every single one of us, and it's not played. I find it a really emotional scene to watch, but, you know, it's played for real. It's not played for tears, I don't think.
No, I think, you know, obviously Brian, the actor, was very ill in real life as well, you know, so
really?
We had to sort of think long and hard about that. But it was we'd played father and son quite a few times and spoke about stuff. And, I mean, Brian was, you know, without wanting to get too wanky about it, but Brian was meant to represent a part of Wales is dying out as well. Those industrial men who we don't have anymore because obviously there's no mines left. So there's no, you know, there's no sense of, there's no continuation of them. So, you know, that whole speech was meant to represent a generation of men that are going now. They were very strong, you know, went underground at 15, had behaved a certain way. They joined a union. They stayed married for life and all the things my father did, really, you know, and behaved a certain way and had a certain set of standards and morals, which were, I thought, you know, quite incredible and sadly are, you know, being lost, you know, but, you know, life changes, that's what it's all about and all the rest. And I didn't want to get nostalgic about it. I just wanted to say it the way it is. And
Johnny, you had me at that the scene where you just stood next to your dad in your postman's outfit.
Yeah.
And nothing's being said, but obviously everything's being said because it's kind of like he's really saying, I love you, son, good luck.
Yeah. That's exactly it, you know. And he kind of, only Brian could have played that part and the way he did, because he'd worked in the steelworks in Ebbervale and then had this extraordinary life where he'd been, you know, a pop star, a soap star, a film star, a present. I mean, an amazing guy, yeah. and somebody that, you know, I knew would be able to sort of carry that off. And I was aware that he was ill, and I spoke to him and said, you know, I've written this part and, you know, it's a bit close to home, but, you know, and he came straight back, read the part, went, I really want to play it. And I mean, he passed away not long after we finished filming, but his wife did say that it gave him a lease that last, you know, sort of month where we filmed and stuff, where he wanted to do it desperately. And so there's a lot of poignancy in those scenes and the way he talks and the advice he gives. And, you know, there's a great moment where he sort of says to me, he says the story about going underground at 15, which was the story my grandfather told me, where they knock the lights off first day just to sort of just have a laugh and test you.
Yeah.
But he says that great line where he goes, I was nervous, but I didn't show it. And just him saying that is him saying to his son, you know, there's going to be rough times in life, and you those men, you've got to keep a game face. You know, we all sort of fall about too easy sometimes, you know, and go, oh, this, well, you can't do that. Sometimes when the going gets rough, you've got to man up, really, you know. And I love the fact that he sort of said that to him, where he was going to him, you know, I'm going now, I'm leaving this plane, this earth, but you know what, life's up and down, and sometimes you've just got to man up, you know. And I like the fact that Brian, the way he said that.
And he's one of many sort of faces that people watching it will recognise. I mean, along with Vicky, you've got Martin Freeman, you've got Maxine Peake, you've got Matt Berry, and one of my faves, Michael Smiley.
Yeah.
As well as cameos with people like Alan McGee. How do you go about getting a cast like that for a film?
I mean, basically what I did was I wrote the script, and obviously the reputation of the Viral was quite strong and solid, and I sent the script out, and you know, touch wood, I'll say it now, I got 100% hit rate. I really, Martin was the first one to fall into place. Martin contacted me, he seen the Viral, Martin Freeman, and said he loved it and could he be in it. And I kind of went, yeah, you know, I loved Martin in The Office. It was really weird, it was like a perfect storm. Just as he did the Viral, he got a part, he told me, in a series of Sherlock Holmes. And it was actually one of those ones where I just went, all right, okay, you don't think, you know, because it's yet another remake. And then about 2 months later, he said to me, I got a part as The Hobbit.
Yes.
And I was like, hell, you know. So there was an amazing sort of, you know, momentum started behind Martin. And what happened was the private investors that got involved who were looking to go into the film said that if you can get Martin to do this film, we will provide the funding for the script to make it. Amazing, okay. Really. And I emailed Martin, and he was in New Zealand, and he sent an email back. It's quite amazing. Just two lines, three lines going, I will do this film. I am back on these dates, and I will film for Johnny for Svengali. And that was it. Money dropped. Simple as that, on an email that Martin sent. He came home, and he filmed his scenes. We had to film him a week before we started the proper filming, because obviously it was tight for Martin. He flew home from New Zealand, filmed Svengali. I asked Maxine Peake. I had this weird thing, Stuart. I don't know what it is. I always thought Maxine Peake and Martin looked like a great mod couple. So I approached, because she was in the Northern Soul as well, and obviously Martin's a mod.
Okay.
And I approached her, and she said yes. And I think what happens is once Martin Freeman's on a film, you go to other actors and you go, Martin Freeman's attached. They kind of go, oh, okay, that's, I'm interested, you know, and I'm up for it. Mm. But the other big one, obviously, was Vicky. I heard her on Radio 1 before Christmas being interviewed by Edith Bowman. She came across as very funny and warm. You know, a lot more to her than just lol, you know. And I thought, you know, maybe she's up to a comedy. I didn't know. She just won the BAFTA. I mean, everybody was after her like they are now. But, you know, bless her, I sent her the script, and she came on board. And once Vicky had dropped, as they say, into the film, I didn't really care then after. I was kind of like just going, it doesn't really matter. I know, we'll get tried for these other actors, like Kieran Griffiths, I really wanted from Shameless to play the Mank. And if we get them, brilliant. But they all said yes, you know. But it was Martin and Vicky that were pivotal to the film. And
from an actor's point of view, then, Vicky.
Sorry, say again.
From an actor's point of view, when you're sent a script, what are you looking? What are you looking for when you pick it up?
I'm just hoping I get to read it to the end. I'm joking.
It's a fair point. It's a fair point.
It is a fair point. And you know what? There are certain scripts where you pick it up and you kind of go, oh, this is going to be hard work. I've got to read it because it could get better.
Yeah.
You know, and I could be missing something here. So you do. You read the whole thing. But, you know, Svengali for me was, it came at the right time, at the perfect time more than anything, because I wasn't so much looking for a comedy and, you know, ringing my agent and saying, send me comedy scripts. Mm. But I've been doing comedy at the TV workshop, you know, since I was 11 years old. We was always messing about with different characters, you know, and funny things. And I massively enjoyed it. It's just, you know, because of the roles that I've had, I've always kind of been sent darker and more serious, strong female roles, which is, you know, brilliant because I love playing them. But it's, when this came through, I thought, I haven't seen anything like this before. I absolutely love the character and I desperately want to play her, but I love all the characters around her. You know, I loved Horsey. He was, you know, he's a right arse in it, but he's a great character. And I spoke to Johnny on the phone and you know what? I just thought, I want to work with him every single day because he was on the same level as me. We had, you know, the same idea. And you know, when you know that you're going to work with good people, that makes even more difference. You know, put the script aside. If you're working with people that aren't on the same page as you and you haven't got things in common and you're not going to want to work in the same kind of way, you know, it's going to be a rough ride. So the fact that me and Johnny got on well so quick and, you know, he did tell me, yeah, we've got people like Martin Freeman and Maxine Peake, and obviously it's appealing. Yeah. But, you know, even if Martin and Maxine and all these people weren't in it, I'd have still gone with it.
And ultimately, she still is a, Shell still is a strong character, isn't she? She's not.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's just not she maudlin, is.
She's,
is it? It's just not maudlin.
I've kind of described her as a bit fluffy because she's kind of, you know, she's not girly, but she likes dresses and she likes to wear bright colours. And, you know, she is girly. She's definitely got that. But she's got this strong edge to her, which is why Dixie and Shell are such a good balance, because, you know, that's where Dixie sometimes sort of, you know, that's where he's not such a strong character in, you know, he'll just do whatever anybody asks, whereas Shell would be the one to step in and say, no, don't do that just because they've told you to.
Yeah, yeah, no, defo.
But yeah, I mean, to me, they're beautiful. When we was working on it, it was obviously a lot of fun and we enjoyed it. But I remember when I started to watch the edit and, you know, everybody that's seen the film that's come up to us afterwards, they've always gone, you know, their chemistry and connection is just, you know, second to none. And yeah, fine, we're together. So there's going to be an extra, you know, you can't get that if you're not genuinely in love or you know, together. But, you know, we were acting and we're not the characters.
Of course.
It means a lot to me that people have captured that. And there's nothing nicer than seeing a genuinely in love couple on screen that have got each other's backs, you know.
Yeah, no, she's kind of riding the same wave of optimism that Dixie is.
She's uprooted to London with him. Yeah, you know, yeah. She's living in the flat of hell. It's like she knows that he's passionate, and his passion is just the same as Johnny's passion for the film Svengali. You know, he's literally lived and breathed to this since the day, you know, him and I keep saying Horsey.
Roger,
you know, even thought about it, and you've got to be dedicated and you've got to love what it is you're doing. And Dixie's definitely got that in the film, and Johnny's certainly got that with, you know, the creating of Svengali.
And you touch upon, I mean, Horsey's was my favourite character in the final, and because obviously having worked in the music business, as it were, he's very representative of a certain strand. Despite obviously you've got the relationship with Dixie to play in there, but certainly that I haven't got a clue really what's going on, but I'm in it.
Yeah,
is a very accurate representation.
It's that classic guy as well. You know, there's that dynamic in the film which we spoke, you know, about me and Raj, is that he's the successful record label manager, but of course the irony is he's the most clueless when it comes to music. And there's a lovely moment where Roger says to him, "How do you do it? You know, how do you discover the bands? You know, how do you know about sort of, you know, the Roses and when you were kids and the Jam and whatever?" So there's that thing where he's kind of even admitting there in a moment of sort of, you know, truthfulness. You know, how come it's you then, Dix? You know, you act like the idiot, but how come you found this band? You know, and something he can't do, even though he's up there. And he's that classic guy as well. He's moved to London.
Mm.
You know, a lot of people do it, you know, and fair enough to them. They invent a new life, you know. They go away and they're Brian now. They're not Horsey anymore. And they're, you know, they want to forget the previous life when they grew up and, you know, being in the sticks. Because now they're a successful sort of, you know, cosmopolitan London person.
Well, yeah, no, and that's what made, that contrast is what made, obviously, Dixie's return back to the Valley is all the more pertinent in the way the film was done. You know, the fact that you, the Dixie character has no truck, we're going back. You know, what was there is important, whereas obviously Brian's character is basically waved bye-bye to that the minute he got off the train.
Yeah, absolutely. There's, I mean, there's the, you know, he's like you said, he's got, you know, he's in G-Star now, and he's got his, you know, he's got his Shoreditch beard, and he's designer glasses, and he's got a lovely flat on the Docklands. You know, he's, why would he want to go back to Wales? You know, Wales was, you know, a rainy grey place for him. You know,
I did so, like his jacket though, I must admit.
Said again, yeah, I know.
I did like his jacket.
Well, we did speak about that, you know, and he sort of, you know, he obviously wanted a leather satchel, man bag and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You sort of, it's beautiful, really, what he said. I mean, we filmed that 2 years ago, and he had sort of those weird trousers they wear that they roll up. What do they call them? Like shallots or what they call them? Those trousers, those weird trousers that are almost halfway up to your knee and tight.
Oh, I can't be doing it. Yeah, I know what you mean, but yeah. Sort of French circus mix, pants, I think, aren't they?
Yeah, he's so he had a pair of them on, you know, and that was right where they were first being worn, you know, and now they're very fashionable around here. But, so, you know, he thought long and hard about that, Rog, as the character, and he was brilliant. But, I mean, everybody says, I mean, it's the most defining moment of a Welshman in pants, probably since Rhys Evans in Notting Hill, those pants that he's got. But what he did was, we went to this flat to film,
yeah,
and we shouldn't really say this, and he found a pair of knickers that were tiger print, and he put them on. So they were knickers, they weren't even pants. Just very Roger.
Graceful.
Just very Roger, you know.
That's a man living for his art. He's living for his art, exactly. There, I guess. But I mean, again, going back to moments, that little few minute or two in his apartment,
yeah,
where he's showing his vulnerable side, for want of a better expression.
Yeah.
And so Dixie's still wonderfully unaware that really what's going on, because Dixie just lives his life like that, you know.
Yeah.
It is all emotional. You're not having to hide it.
No.
I thought that was done really well. Again, it's not about what's said, it's about what's not said in many senses.
Yeah, I mean, it's that kind of thing. Do you know when you first, you know, everybody has had their heart broken once or twice in life, you know, or whatever time. And those first few days where you're almost as if you're underwater, you know. It's almost like as if you're thinking about constantly about something else other than the world that's going on. And with Dixie, like you said, you know, I'm glad you picked up on that. He's just split up with Shell, and that has kind of almost overwhelmed him, you know, that he's lost Shell, you know. And he's actually saying that thing where he's going, this all doesn't matter now. I just need to get home. He's panicking. You know, I need to get home so I can start again and think about getting her back. And everything else, like the band and stuff, has just slipped. And, you know, and so Horsey, like you're saying, beautifully waits for that moment where he can slip in really as well. So he's kind of, he opens up, but as soon as he opens up, he kind of, he's, the shark eyes come in again, and he's waiting for the moment where he can ride in on the back of what Dixie's going to do. So, you know, Dixie, like you said, at that point is in kind of an emotional shock as well, where Shell has finally left him. I kind of seen him as that couple. We've never spent a day apart, you know. Those couples who, like, since the day they've met, they've practically moved into bed together and been together ever since. So for one of them to leave would literally, you know, be, you know, a trauma really for the other one, you know, for them both, obviously, because Shell's the same. She's on the extension straight away listening for him when he's ringing. But
it's really clever as well, because I remember in the edit them saying something like, you know, from the start, it's Shell and Dixie all the way through the film.
Yeah.
And then for a really big chunk of the film, Shell's just not around.
No, I did that in the script on purpose. Yeah. And slips away from his life.
It's really, really clever, though, because the audience are kind of going, where the hell has she gone?
Yeah.
And you see him sort of on his own with this band. And, you know, I just thought that was really clever. You could have kept, you know, cutting back to what she's doing and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, they let her go, which I think was great.
We had to feel, as the viewer, the loneliness of him by Shell not being there, you know. And I did that thing that Scorsese did very well with Goodfellas, where he famously wrote shorter and shorter scenes as the film went on, where his life spun more out of control. And I did that with Svengali, where as he breaks into his flat and he goes to Scotland, and he's there, and it almost like speeds up where he's out of control and the film feels like it's, you know, it's very quick, sharp. Scenes where, you know, we get a reflection of how his life is, really, where he's kind of almost, you know, losing hours as he's travelling around and doesn't quite know where he is, really, you know.
Yeah, lost. I mean, he doesn't have a life without Shell, does he? Even the fact you don't see her, you know that that's all that's occupying his mind.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we spoke quite long and hard about, in the montage in Scotland where he's in the train, you know, we just caught a moment of him just gazing, you know, that the pain that he's in, you know, he's in so much pain where he's trying to, and he believes that by getting the band signed, as McGee has told him that great line, get the band signed, you get the girl back, as flicks him back into action again, you know, which was something my older brother told me once. I split up with a girl and he went to me, you know, if you get this, you know, job or whatever, and show you're all right again, you know, she'll come back to you. You know, that kind of classic sort of rubbish male advice you get about how to get a girl back, you know. So he's kind of got that, you know, going on as well. And he's clung on to it, you know, which we do in desperation. But he's gone, yes, that's the secret. If I get the band signed now, she'll come back to me, you know, which was actually was completely wrong. The irony was, you know, he would get her back by walking away from the band.
As well as the kind of tender moments that I was that I liked and I've pointed out, is that the bit that really makes it cinematic is the beautiful contrast between what is London and what is the Valleys, which really helps set the mood. But also there's a little bit of kind of, I don't know whether you'd call it ambition or not, but the scene when this is without giving it context, hopefully it's not a spoiler, but when you do go to Scotland,
yeah,
and you're in the canoe,
yeah.
Now it would have been easier from a writing point of view, wouldn't it, to set that in a pub?
Yes.
And suddenly we're like, how far is he out of London? He's this far.
Yeah, it's kind of like it's meant to sort of represent how, like, as just as you said, you picked it up perfectly. How far out of his own body he is at that point, how far away he is from everything that he is, grounded, slightly sort of like lovely, naive Welshman who really likes music. At that point, you know, he's on the roller coaster and he just don't know where he's gonna end up. And I spoke quite long and hard about Scotland and Wales, that it should look massively cinematic, wide shots of you know, open space and mountains and lakes, which is what those sort of Celtic countries are. Yeah. And the colours also slightly different, because the Celtic people, you know, Welsh, Irish, Scottish, are slightly different to the sort of English, more Germanic people and Nordic people in the way they are, you know, the personalities of the people. Something in the DNA is slightly more whimsical, I would say, you know, slightly more sort of, you know, there's stories about fairies and leprechauns and all those kind of classic things. So I wanted to make the colour a little bit different as well. And we did that. And the camera lady was brilliant on that, where we said, we really need to open the camera up on these bits and to colour it slightly different so that you're almost in like a different country.
Well, yeah, it definitely worked. Well, from my point of view, it definitely worked. Congratulations on that.
You're the first person to pick up on that. Well done, Stuart.
Do I get a prize?
You do, actually, yeah.
Well, look, I mean, you know, I'm from the Northwest, so I'm not, you know, with a bit of Irish and Scottish blood in me, so I'm...
That's probably where it is. Do you know, we've got a lot of support. Always a lot of support from the Northwest, Liverpool and Manchester, those areas. And
yeah,
they've both picked up on it for cinema as well. It's playing there for a week from the 21st, both cities. You know, it's an area that's always loved Svengali. Funny.
Well, I guess, I mean, the thing is, we all end up going to London for one reason or another. You know, plenty of people come to London from all around the world, but for us, it's 2 hours on a train.
Yeah.
So you're kind of like, it's like, I guess the rest of the world sees London like we might see New York.
Yeah.
Did you know it's sort of a place to go to, whereas it's an
I wanted to get that in the film as well, because he leaves Wales in the morning and he gets to London like by midday.
Yeah.
And you know, in America, to get New York, you're saying it's 3 days from the Midwest, whereas in Wales, it's 2 hours. It is from Cardiff Central. So I wanted to get that involved in a different world, you know, within 2 or 3 hours. And I was writing this, I was thinking about that when I was writing the script, because obviously there's the First World War celebration, you know, not celebrations, but, you know, where they're talking about the history bit. And they used to say that they could hear the Western Front from Kent. And they were saying that the soldiers used to say that it was 2 hours from the front to get to Calais and then to Dover. They were within hours home. So you can actually be in a war zone in a few hours, you know, in the world. But people often think that things are far away. We do still believe that things go on another side of the world and traveling to cities. But actually, it's, you know, sometimes we're dead close to things and we don't realise. You know, so you've got a guy waiting at a train station with a donkey, only 2 hours away from London, where it's all tubes and trains and all sorts going on, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's like I say. I mean, we have this stupidly disproportionate world city in the tiniest country.
Yeah, absolutely right. And what I wanted to do as well was, which is very, I thought, very British, was I wanted to sort of, the only thing I couldn't do was obviously fly, but I wanted him sort of to be, you know, he was running and he was on a fucking car and then he was in a train and then, you know, and then he was fucking on a horse. Every mode of travel I could possibly think of, based on the ground, he was, you know, doing, because that's what London's like. You know, you're always on popping out the tube stations and you're always on the go, you know. It's like, it's a really quick moving city. I always remember moving to London thinking, I don't need to join a gym. I never put a pound on up there. You know, it is true. You don't see massively overweight people walking around London because you can't, because the tubes and everything, everything moves at such a pace and everybody's walking up the steps and down and down. But it's just, it's a very lean city. That's what I always thought. Everything about it is fast and, you know.
Yeah, you only have to change tubes at Bank Station between the Northern Line and the Central Line every day.
And you're walking for like an hour under there. Do you know what I mean? I wanted to capture that. There's lots of stuff where you know, he's running around and he's always on the move and always on the go. I kind of felt with Dixie, the moment he stopped, he was going to die. You know, I mean, the only time I took my jacket off was when he goes to Horsey's flat, was the armour comes off at that point. You know, it's like.
I think that's the difference between. I mean, that's what you get beautifully when you go back to Wales, and I certainly get this when I go back to, because I live like North Manchester, not in the middle of it.
Yeah.
You get the sense that the world can stop for a bit.
Yeah. Absolutely. Things slow down. We even spoke about, you know, the lad who plays the guy with the horse, Shrek, Carwin, was a very good actor. We even spoke about slowing down slightly, the out the way we speak, that the pace of everything has suddenly slowed down. So he's in London and there's a bit where me and Roger are talking, and a lot of people picked up that they love the rhythm of the way we speak, where I'm going to him, I managed the band, you know, they were Brummies. Do you remember? Guy kept trying to kill himself, threw himself under a train, set fire to him. And everybody loves the rhythm of that. But when we got back to Wales with Carwin, I wanted to slow down where he goes, where you been, then? London, is it? You know, they've all got the time in the world, you know, and that's why we put that Pogues song there, which has almost got a almost like a Southern American sort of country feel to it, where he's somewhere that's, you know, down and down. It's like almost like you expect different music to start playing and everything slows down slightly, you know, the pace of everything slows down.
How, and that reminds you, how much of the film's budget went on music? Because there's some classics in there.
I mean, a lot of people sort of say it's one of the best British soundtracks ever, which is amazing because we've got everything in there from every decade, from the 50s to the noughties, and I purposely did that. And but what happened was, it's a bit very similar to Martin Freeman. Martin Freeman agreed to do the film for Equity Minimum, which is amazing. So that means all every other actor sort of went the same route. But otherwise, because, you know, you could pay, you know, £500,000 for Martin just to do 2 days and something, which is fair enough.
Yeah.
But he did it for Equity Minimum, which is amazing. And then what happened was, I asked for a song by The Who, High Numbers, called Zoot Suit, and we had to get in touch with Pete Townsend, and he agreed to do it at a really, really cheap rate to Bessem because he really liked it and he really liked the idea. And once we said we had The Who, very similar to Martin, all the other acts followed suit, so everybody I asked said yes. And I think because it was a film about rock and roll, and it was a rock and roll comedy that looks at it with a, you know, and kind of portrays a lot of the characters where they are, everybody sort of said, yeah, well, I want to be part of this. So we kind of got a lot of stuff for mates rates.
Excellent. In terms of shooting in London, from a practical point of view, how easy or how hard was that in terms of pulling the film together?
Solid. But it was great because we got so lucky with the weather, and we got so lucky with stuff like, obviously, we filmed in Piccadilly Circus. I mean, Piccadilly Circus is as busy as Piccadilly Circus, as the saying goes. Yeah. So we were kind of going through, and we did this first one, Vic, you'll remember, where we were going, don't look at the camera, don't look at the camera. And of course, everybody was looking at the camera. So then we went, well, this is not working. So this is like 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, on a weekend, I think it was as well. And so we just went, let's just fucking shoot. Let's just go through this and let's just shoot. And we did it and nobody looked at the camera. It's amazing. So when we sort of learned that, it was obviously the scenes that were packed solo and stuff, we just shot and we kept it quite lean. We kept it just a camera and somebody bashing behind if they were walking. And you know, the sound man. So we tried to keep it as lean as we could, so we didn't arrive with big trucks and stuff. So it was really classic guerrilla shooting. Get in, shoot it, and get out. And that's what we had to do, because we did try the, you know, we're going to just start shooting. It doesn't work. People start watching. People start asking for money and so on. And all those kind of classic things start happening. So we just went, right, we're going to make a decision here. It's going to have to go back to what it was like with the virals, where we just get a camera and shoot.
There's a guy in one of the scenes where Johnny's trying to get, Dixie's trying to get directions.
Oh, yeah, the black kid in Camden Market.
He was a real deal, wasn't he?
That was true.
I love that.
We had to go into him after and sign him up. But basically, when I say to the guy, do you know where Inverness Street is? And he goes, it's down there, brother. And I go, is that you selling CDs? And he goes, yeah. And I go, I do tapes. And I give him a tape. But right on the brow of the bridge, going over the canals in Camden, that's a real guy. We had to go into him after and say to him, look, we're filming. Dixie just asked you the way, are you happy to be in it? He was like, absolutely. And he just signed his form. So that was real.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. Yeah. I remember that scene. That's
yeah. Bless him.
Well, look, let's remind everybody when the film is out.
Yes.
When is it released?
It's out on the 21st of March.
And when are people going to be able to see it already, as it were?
Yes, people will be able to see it. It's available on for what do you call it, video on demand and stuff from the 21st as well. It's in independent cinemas. It's got a smashing independent release all around the country. I'm going to do some Q&As. I want you to come to the Manchester show on the 21st at the AMC. Sean Ryder's coming as well, so you've got to come to that. So we're all over the place. Me and Vicky are hoping to do a little mini tour as well and doing Q&As and stuff and just getting out there to see what people think of it and hopefully they enjoy it.
Okay, okay. Well, look, Britflix is right behind you.
Oh, bless you.
I certainly enjoyed it.
Well, you know what? I'm a big fan. As soon as they said to me Britflix, I was like, yes, absolutely.
well, look, just as what we like to do as well is like a recommendation. So there might be a bit of a pause here while you think.
Yeah.
So the pair of you, recommend me a British music film that you feel fondly about or like or you love.
Okay, cool. Do you want me to go first?
I'll go first because I know which one I want and he'll know more than I do. Stone Roses.
Go on.
Well,
yeah. It's a documentary, is it?
Yeah, Made of Stone.
Okay.
Yeah. So best one I've ever seen.
How do you want to say it? Do you need to say it sort of so you can...
What is it about Made of Stone that you like a lot compared to the average music film?
Well, what I liked about it was the interview footage that they got obviously has never really been seen before.
Mm.
And it kind of, you know, it wasn't a kind of documentary where it was, let's talk about how they split up and how bad it all got. And, you know, it was about the fans as much as it was about the band. And, you know, obviously the shots that were used were sort of, you know, it was a bit of a piece of art by the time you'd finished.
Yes.
So, you know, Shane obviously directed it. I'm always going to be biased, but it was one of those documentaries that I watched and, you know, I kind of stood up a few times and had a little dance because I was just so engrossed in it all. So, yeah, that's why.
I think that's a top recommendation. What about you, Johnny?
It's a very tight call for me because there's very little between them. But I was a huge fan of Saturday Night Fever. And I was a huge fan of what they tried to do with it, where they portrayed working class life that we would know very well, where you dress on the weekend and you embrace those 2 days when you're the peacock to the local club and pub and stuff. So I always loved Saturday Night Fever. I thought it was a fantastic film with a great soundtrack. But I'm going to go with Quadrophenia.
Had to be, really.
Yeah, simply because it is the most important film I've ever watched because it set me on this road to sort of where I've ended up today, really, sort of musically and film-wise. I still think it's a superb film. There's so much energy in it, and it's so British, but it's so universal. The story of the teenager, you know, bless him, has that sort of out-of-control weekend that sort of ends in disaster for him. But, you know, the whole story of, you know, how he dresses, how he looks, how he goes out on the weekend, you know, even the drugs that he takes, you know. Mm. It's just such a brilliant, universal teenage story. And how fucked up we are at that age as well, how full of hormones we all are and, you know, and a mess. And, you know, superb performances. They've all gone on to be, you know, some of the stalwarts of British cinema and TV for the last 20 years. It's amazing, really. But, and obviously the soundtrack, without compare, I mean, that whole album that the way Townsend wrote and the way that he got in the mind of a teenager, just genius. I mean, just a brilliant, brilliant movie that certainly reflects the Britain that I know and love.
Okay, well, look, I'd say that Svengali is a fairly good representation of the Britain I know, so...
Oh, bless you.
So, good luck with it, and thank you very much for the pair of you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Stuart, keep on keeping on, brother. We love Britflix.
It's the Britflix.com podcast. It's the Britflix.com podcast.